Welcome to Songcraft, Spotlight on Songwriters, a bi-weekly podcast featuring in-depth conversations with and about the creators of lyrics and music that stand the test of time. I'm Scott B. Beaumont.
And I'm Paul Duncan. To make sure you don't miss an episode, please take a moment to subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can also keep up with us on social media by searching for one word, Songcraft Show, or visit us at songcraftshow.com.
And if you believe in the Songcraft mission, please consider supporting us by visiting patreon.com/songcraftshow.
Our guest on this episode of Songcraft is three-time Grammy nominee and Ivor Novello Award winner Richard Thompson. Named as one of the top 20 guitarists of all time by Rolling Stone magazine, Thompson began his career as one of the architects of the British folk rock movement with his band Fairport Convention in the late 1960s. The 1970s and early 80s brought a series of critically acclaimed duo albums by Richard and his then-wife Linda Thompson. Two of those releases, I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight and Shoot Out the Lights, were named among Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Albums of All Time. Returning to a solo career after the musical and marital partnership concluded, Thompson has released more than 20 solo studio albums and film soundtracks, and has earned Lifetime Achievement Awards from the Americana Music Association and the BBC Awards. He was bestowed with an Order of the British Empire by Queen Elizabeth II at Buckingham Palace, and his song 1952 Vincent Black Lightning was named by Time magazine on its list of the 100 Greatest Songs since 1923. As influential a songwriter as he is a guitarist, Richard's music has been covered by Elvis Costello, Robert Plant, Don Henley, R.E.M., Sleater Kinney, David Byrne, Linda Ronstadt, the Five Blind Boys of Alabama, Emmylou Harris, Bonnie Raitt, Los Lobos, the Del McCoury Band, David Gilmour, Alison Krauss, Patti Loveless, Sean Colvin, and Loudon Wainwright III, among others. Algonquin Books recently released the paperback version of Richard's memoir, Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975.
Part 1.
Well, Paul, the reason that we had the opportunity to speak with Richard Thompson today, we'd probably have the opportunity anytime because I'm sure.
We're charming.
Yeah. He would love to speak with us.
Yeah.
But the reason that he is doing a round of interviews right now is because the paperback version of his memoir, Bee's Wing, came out. And that's something that we talk about throughout the interview with him.
Yeah.
But it kind of got me thinking about this idea that, you know, you and I are guys who love to listen to music, but probably almost as much we love to talk about music and to read about music.
Yeah.
And I remember I've shared this before, but in case some folks out there haven't listened to every word of every minute of every podcast we've ever done, there was kind of a funny story that happened a few years ago. It was when the Beatles anthology book came out, which is a large book.
It's a tome.
Yeah. And it's oversized, and I was laying in bed reading that book, which is kind of like a workout in of itself to lay on your back and hold that thing up. Right. If you doze off, it could be deadly.
Right.
So my wife walks in the room just kind of brushing her teeth or something, absentmindedly getting ready for bed, and just looks at me and goes, "You know, music's for listening to, not reading about, right?"
Oh,
and
fighting words.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, hold on a minute. Hold on. So, but I have often wondered if I had to give up listening to music or reading about music, it would be tough for me. I really enjoy both. So I thought, you know, now that we've got Richard on the show today, and I just finished reading Bee's Wing, which I thought was an interesting memoir and not the way that most people approach music memoirs. I thought I'd just ask, you know, what have you been reading? What are some music books that we can talk about?
Well, it's interesting that you asked me that question and you ask it that way, because, you know, I was a literature major, and people will sometimes ask a question like, "Hey, do you read?" And my response will be, "Well, I can read." After that era of study, I stopped kind of reading the classics, and I just went straight into rock and roll books. So, yes, I'm with you. I think music should be read about and listened to. And there are certain books that I actually have read more than once that I'll kind of come back to. And particularly in this sort of season of Beatle Renaissance that everyone seems to be enjoying after the Get Back documentary, I've sort of combed back through some of my Beatle books.
Right.
And there are some that are kind of like, considered the standard. Like, there's a book by Bob Spitz just called The Beatles.
Yes, I have that book.
Yeah. Which I think might be sort of recognized as like the book.
Yeah, it's certainly in a world packed with Beatle books, it's one of the more revered.
You could say Bob Spitz wrote the book on the Beatles.
Yes, indeed.
But beyond that, there were a couple of books kind of that were a little bit more coming in the side door on the Beatles story. One of them being a book by Jeff Emmerich, longtime engineer of Beatle Records, yes, called Here, There, and Everywhere.
Yes, great book.
Yeah, that's a fun look at sort of the recording process and what making those records meant to him, which is a little bit just less about the Fab Four and more about the process and what he went through.
Right.
There's another one called You Never Give Me Your Money, which was written by a guy named Peter Doggett.
Yeah.
And that one's really cool because it talks about the breakup of the Beatles and all the contracts they were entangled with at the time. And, you know, if they kind of invented, you know, being a rock band in a way, they also invented splitting up.
Right.
It was kind of like, you know, one of the first breakups of that magnitude.
Yeah.
And to see what those guys had to deal with contractually and legally is really fascinating.
Peter Doggett also wrote a book I like a lot called Are You Ready for the Country? And it's about like Bob Dylan and Graham Parsons and the birth of country rock, so to speak. I think that's the first book I read by him. He's a good writer. I will say, in terms of what I've been reading recently, I just recently finished a book by a guy named Mark Elliott called The Hag, The Lifetimes and Music of Merle Haggard. This book is on Amazon, and as of today, as I'm saying this, it has 256 reviews with an average of 4.5 stars.
Wow.
And I want to say I would give this book 1 star. It was,
wow,
it was terrible. And I can see how if someone knew nothing about Merle Haggard and they just read this book and they went, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. But there are factual errors galore to the point of song titles wrong.
Wow.
Yeah, it's unreal. I mean, there are paragraphs where there are 3 to 4 incorrect facts in a single paragraph. And now, to be fair, I'm a big Bakersfield Sound guy. I'm a big Merle Haggard person. There's a lot of minutia that, sure, I recognize as incorrect that other people would have no idea. And I don't expect somebody reading a book to go in and already be an expert, but...
But you expect the author.
Yes.
If he's going to get into the minutia,
yeah,
then get the minutia right.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Just things like him talking about, oh, you know, on such and such a date in 1953, they drove down to the, you know, Capitol Studios at the corner of Hollywood and Vine. Well, that studio didn't exist yet in 1953. It wasn't built yet. You know,
right,
it was a couple years later, 2 or 3 years later before it was. There's a lot of stuff like that where if you didn't know, you just read right over and go, okay.
Right.
And maybe the arc of the whole story, but that kind of stuff really bugs me. So I have to say, there needs to be a definitive biography of Merle Haggard. This is not it. So do not be fooled by the Amazon reviews. I am giving this the opposite of an endorsement. But I will say what I have been listening to, an audiobook, and I don't listen to a lot of audiobooks. I do most of my reading in the retro style with the eyes.
Right. Well, yeah, can you imagine reading about music and listening to books? That makes no sense at all.
The world's upside down. Yeah. But I just went on a backpacking trip where I was walking all day for 8 days, and that's a good time to switch to the audiobook. And I've been listening to Brandi Carlile's book, which I think is called Broken Horses, and it's a memoir of her life. And that's really cool because she sits down between chapters and plays songs like on acoustic piano or acoustic guitar. And they're usually a song that has something to do with that chapter. And she was influenced by a lot of the same. I think she's about the same age we are and was influenced by a lot of the same music we were. She was obsessed with Elton John and Bernie Taupin. Yeah. Like that was kind of her first, you know, and she talks about Indigo Girls and the soundtrack of Philadelphia, a lot of touchstones that I feel like were important, you know, musical moments for us. So I will say as much as I disliked The Hag, I give a double thumbs up to Brandi Carlile's book. That's a great, great music memoir.
You know, and props to you for listening to a book on the trail, because I was just wondering what's more dangerous, reading a paperback book while hiking the Appalachian Trail or holding that Beatles anthology above your face.
Yeah, I like to live on the edge, you know?
Both dangerous. You know, you mentioned Elton John in Brandi Carlile's list of influences. You know, we've talked about it before. I'm a huge Elton John fan. And the Philip Norman Elton John biography was a big one for me a while back. Now, I've sort of heard some people take some shots at Philip Norman for his accuracy as, right, a writer, but everything that I read in that Elton book seemed to check out. I also read Elton's book, his autobiography, just called Me,
right,
which I thought was actually a little less entertaining, strangely enough. I think often artists don't find the things interesting about themselves that I find interesting about them.
Yeah.
But I will say, if you want a book written by the artist himself, that's an incredible book, an incredible piece of writing, and lets you in on all the things you want to be in on. Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run.
Yes.
Could be the greatest rock book I've ever read.
And written completely solo. He did not work with a co-writer or ghostwriter. That was just Bruce.
It's amazing.
He's a great writer. Yeah.
And Dave Grohl's book, The Storyteller. I'm not sure if he had a co-writer on that one.
Yeah, I don't know.
But it's a really well-written book and great, great fun stories.
I got that book for Christmas. I have not read it yet, but I've heard great things. Another book I got for Christmas is Looking to Get Lost, which is Peter Guralnik, basically anthology of some articles and essays. And it's called, the subtitle is Adventures in Music and Writing. Mm-hmm. So as a person who happens to make his living when he's not podcasting by being a writer and editor of music books, I really love that just because it's awesome to kind of get the story. I mean, Peter Guralnik is a hero.
Incredible.
I think to anybody who loves good music writing, his biographies on
the Elvis books are
the Elvis books are unreal. The Sam Cooke biography he did, Sam Phillips. Yeah. I mean, Peter only puts out a book every decade or so, and it's always like
there's a reason.
Yeah, it's always amazing. I think I wish he would write the definitive Merle Haggard book. That would be incredible. But that's one I really enjoyed a lot. I guess we are just nerds.
Well, and I think we're probably preaching to the choir here. I mean, I think we've got a choir of nerds listening to the podcast with us. I would recommend any one of those books. Also, there's a little book called Southbound, which is a book about Southern rock that I'll make a plug for that my co-host here wrote, which is one heck of a fun book to read. And man, you got to interview some, that was even before we did the podcast.
Yeah.
Those are some serious interview chops.
My early interviewing days, really.
Everybody from the guys in Molly Hatchet, to guys from Lynyrd Skynyrd,
to Hank Williams Jr., which is to this date the only interview I've done with a person who was drunk still in the AM hours. And I'm not talking 2 AM, I'm talking 11. So that was interesting. Charlie Daniels, and which was cool because we both grew up in Nashville, as everyone knows by now. It's all we talk about on here. But I definitely considered Southern rock kind of part of the wallpaper of my formative years, but have never would have considered myself an aficionado. So when the opportunity came to write that book, it was sort of like, oh, it was interesting to come to a genre I was by no means an expert on and come to it with fresh eyes and be like, okay, I know about Lynyrd Skynyrd, I know about Allman Brothers, but what about some of these other bands like Grinder Switch and bands that I hadn't even heard of before?
Yeah.
And I got to kind of like dig in a very intense and compressed time frame to educate myself and then hopefully, you know, kind of put it all together in a way that makes sense.
You spent a little more time with Black Oak, Arkansas than maybe you had before.
Just a little. Yeah. And me and Jim Dandy, boy, there's a guy that,
there's,
you know, hold on and take a ride on that interview. I think for my own writing, you know, I think some of the most fun that I've had as a writer is doing the autobiographies with Wanda Jackson. And then I co-wrote Lamont Dozier's autobiography, and, you know, just to get in the mind, you know, you're putting yourself in the mind of the person that you're working with.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was amazing to just spend all that time with Lamont and get in the mind of somebody who's written some of the most iconic songs. And, that actually came about because he was on the podcast. So built a relationship.
There's no question that your writing career has helped our podcast. I'm glad that at least once the podcast was able to help your writing career. So
yeah,
we do what we can around here.
I think, you know, the podcast scratches our back and we scratch its back.
Mm.
Song back.
Part two.
This episode of Songcraft is brought to you by the fine folks at Pearl Snap Studios, a group of people you could say wrote the book on recording songs. And if you're ready to enter that next chapter of your songwriting career, let Justin and the producers at Pearl Snap Studios help you turn the page into the next phase of what you're doing. What do you think about that?
That's some excellent book punnery.
Thank you.
I'm keeping an index of your puns, and
wow,
I'm going to add that in there because that's how good it was.
That's some good content.
So Anyway, let me just dust off my jacket. No, that was a reach.
That was bad.
But no, Justin and his team at Pearl Snap are the people that you want to reach out to if you are ready to make a demo of one of your songs. Now, you know, you might have been listening to Songcraft for a long time. You might have been getting some inspiration. You might have been honing your own songwriting skills. And, you know, maybe you've heard us talk about Pearl Snap Studios a lot of times and you've thought, well, that doesn't really apply to me. I don't know if I'm ready yet. But time to sit down and evaluate. Maybe you are. Maybe your songs have gotten better than when you started out, and maybe it's time to say, hey, do I have one that I think is ready for the demo treatment? Maybe I'm not ready to pitch that to artists or anything like that yet, but I want to give it to my wife as a gift for her birthday. Yeah. Or I want to, you know, write a song about my kid who's going off to college and you know, send it to him and as a recorded version and let him know, you know, what they mean to me. There's so many things you can do with a demo besides just use it to get a cut on an artist. So yeah. Whether you are a new songwriter who wants to record something for the first time or whether you're a experienced singer-songwriter and you're ready to make a new album, PearlSnapStudios.com is the place where you can go and check out your options.
You've done the part that you do well. Now let them do the part that they do well.
I like that.
How about that?
That is good. I think we can close the book on this ad.
Part 3.
Once again, our guest is 3-time Grammy nominee, songwriting legend, and guitar superhero Richard Thompson, who chats with us about his approach to the craft of writing, the stories behind some of his greatest songs, and the release of the paperback version of his memoir, Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Richard, welcome to Songcraft.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You have recently released the paperback version of your memoir, Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice. And the book covers your music career from 1967 through 1975. And you write in your book, and I'm quoting here, "Songwriting is a strange business, and those who claim to understand the creative process are usually uttering bullshit of the first magnitude." And this is a podcast all about songwriting, so hopefully we will pile up some magnificent bullshit today and see if we can find some nuggets of wisdom in there. But I resonate with your comment there in the book, because there is a mystery to the act of songwriting. I'm wondering if you could comment a bit more on that.
I suppose I could if I really think about it. I think there's the great mystery is the creative process at the heart of songwriting. You can't nail that down yet. You can't say there's a method. You can't say that this is the way to do it. All you can do is offer suggestions, little tricks that might unlock the subconscious, the semi-conscious, ways to get into the process, you know, ways to get yourself into the right state of mind, maybe to be creative and to hit that process that then is a mystery. And then you come out the other side and you've written a song. So I suppose you can talk about, you know, you can talk all around songwriting, but you can't really talk about actual songwriting.
Huh.
Yeah, I remember watching an interview with Tom Petty and someone sort of asked him a little bit about, you know, where songs come from, something kind of that, you know, on that level. And he paused and he said, you know, that's not something that I like to look in the eye too much. And he almost said it from kind of a superstitious place.
Yeah.
Is there any part of you that has that kind of feeling that it's like it's a spiritual process that actually really shouldn't be overanalyzed?
I do. I really do. I think I have the same fear as Tom, actually, that if you dig too deeply, that then you're going to almost mechanize the process.
Yeah.
You're going to say, oh, this is how you do it. This is how I'll do it every time. And you can't really do that. I do see it as a spiritual thing, almost, if you like, that you're a conduit for the music, and the music flows through you. And the gift to you is that process, you know, that you feel that wonderful thing of music coming from somewhere outside of you and flowing through you and becoming material in this world from another world almost. So I take a fairly spiritual view of it, And I almost feel, you know, the music doesn't belong to me. You know, it's almost cheating to say I wrote it. I'll take the royalties, thank you very much. But
right.
Again, I mean, this is another mystery upon mystery. So, yeah. So you've got the mystery of the creative process, and then where it comes from is another strange thing. And then you can get into the, you know, the arriving at that creative point, you know, the various processes, and how desirable is it to, you know, to be like a Nashville style songwriter where there is much more of a method to it. You still can't quite nail it down to a mechanical method, but they come close sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, though the book only covers the first couple of phases of your career, the title is taken from the song Bee's Wing, which is actually not a song from the era that you cover in the book, but was one of the tracks on your 1994 album Mirror Blue. Talk a bit about the connection between the content of that song and the particular focus of the book and how those are interrelated.
I think it's difficult to sum up the 60s, if you like, into the 70s, because there are so many strands to it. It was an extraordinary time, and I was very grateful to be a teenager and then in my early 20s, you know, during those years, because there was a lot going on and a lot of strands were coming together in so many ways in popular music and generally in art and in fashion. All those things, and it was great to be in London at that time, because London really was a music center and a fashion center, and so you were able to absorb an extraordinary amount of stuff. So you had all these strands, you know, like technical things, you know, the things in the studio that the Beatles were doing, for instance, that Les Paul had kind of pioneered some time before, but the Beatles were bringing it properly into popular music. And then you have things like Indian music becoming an influence, a cultural influence. And you had rhythm and blues colliding with Tin Pan Alley and country music sneaking into the edges of popular music. So all these strands were happening. Then you had the drugs, you know, the psychedelia. That was a whole other strand coming in. So you had all these things happening. So it's hard to define that period, and certainly hard to define in one song. But I thought I would take one strand of the 60s, what I felt was important about the 60s, and write a song about that, which was this thing of people dropping out of society, people being unhappy to just follow their parents or follow the advice of the school and go into these straight careers, you know, go to university, get the degree, you know, become an accountant, whatever it was you fancied doing.
Right.
So many people that I knew, and I suppose I did it as well, really, to some extent, was really to drop out and you know, not take that path well trodden, but to to go off, you're traveling, become basically itinerant become a drug dealer and just drop out completely, go abroad, travel. The song Bee's Wing is really, really about a very restless woman who doesn't want to be tied down.
Right.
And the protagonist's kind of pursuit of her and his heartbreak and never really being able to capture her in any sense or have any kind of permanent relationship with her, and in the end she kind of destroys herself to his endless heartbreak.
I took a job in the steaming down on Cardrum Street, and I fell in love with a laundry girl who was working next to me. Well, she was a rare thing, fine as a bee's wing. So fine, a breath of wind might blow her away. She was a lost child, well, she was running wild. She said, as long as there's no price on love, I'll stay. And you wouldn't want me any other way.
So So for me, that's a song about that time period.
Yeah.
And in that way, it seemed appropriate for the title for the book.
Yeah.
Well, your professional career really began with Fairport Convention, a group that formed in 1967. And you joke that the group picked a name that was suitably polysyllabic for the age. And you're right. It's a solid five syllables. If you add a the in front of it, then you get six.
That's right. Yeah.
But, you know, within 2 or 3 months, the band had a record deal. And you point out that the Beatles, having been such credible songwriters, really changed everything so that bands that came in their wake basically had to write their own songs. You know, it was the new expectation. So you started writing songs like If, you know, Stomp, which was on the flip side of the band's first single.
If I were rich enough to make you need me as much as I need you, if I could pitch enough, you'd realize what a little country bread could.
And you write a good bit in the book about your guitar influences, but in terms of songwriting in particular, were there any guiding lights that you were looking to as the band prepared that first album?
Yeah, I think a lot. I think certainly, you know, contemporaries. I mean, people that I worked with, like Sandy Denny, who was, I think, a great songwriter, but very much her own style of songwriter. But I still took some stuff from working with Sandy. And some of the other, you know, kind of traditional bass songwriters like Cyril Tawney, Ewan McColl, but people like that. And then so many of the American writers, certainly country writers like Hank Williams, that seemed in some way quite closely connected to the UK, and you know, it didn't seem that far removed from British music. Just a few generations in the Appalachians kind of switched it to, you know, country music, but it's you know, the melodies are very Scottish, and the themes are actually very Scottish or Irish as well, so not too distant. And then I suppose, you know, listening to Dylan and Joni Mitchell and Leonard Cohen, all of whom were coming through at that time, and realizing that you could say a lot more lyrically. Certainly, I think Dylan was the big game changer. He brought a very poetic style of music to the folk scene, first of all. So from sort of 61, 62 onwards, he was singing, you know, what he hated to be called protest songs, but they were kind of protest songs. And then when he went electric, that changed the whole landscape. That was his great cultural influence. I feel was to amplify folk music, if you like, or the attitudes of folk music, and to bring intelligent lyrics into popular music. So then he influenced the Byrds, he influenced the Beatles, and from that point onwards, you know, everything becomes possible lyrically in popular music. Then you can have Radiohead, and you can have PJ Harvey, and you can have you know, this whole slew of people. You can have Elvis Costello. Being smart lyrically in popular music, and you know, that hadn't happened since, you know, the previous generation, if you like, since Rodgers and Hart or something, or Cole Porter. So that was the big shift, and you know, then the really it became wide open in terms of songwriting. You know, Pink Floyd could write you know, the extraordinarily abstract songs at times, and you write about anything. You could write about, you know, politics. You could write about just about any kind of social thing, any kind of personal problem. It all became fodder, you know, for the songwriter. And thank heavens for that. And thank you, Bob, for opening it all up for us.
Yeah. I think perhaps one of the first songs you ever wrote solo, if not the first, was Meet Me on the Ledge, which became Fairport Convention's first charting single.
Too many friends who try, blown off this mountain with the wind.
On the left.
in the book, writing about the teenage version of yourself versus your current day self, who still performs that song on stage, you say, I no longer share the emotions he felt at the time, so I have to see what new emotions the song arouses in me, or I cannot sing it. Music without emotions is a heinous crime, after all. And when I read that, it got me thinking about the idea of whether or not the meaning of a song is what the writer of that song intended, or if the meaning of a song lies with what the listener interprets. And in some ways, that's an impossible question to answer, but it's something I think of from time to time. But when I read that quote, I thought, oh, I want to ask you this question, because you are someone who has played both the role of the songwriter who intended something very specific in a certain time, but you've also played the role of someone who is still singing that composition, who is very much a different man with, you know, a lot of years between and a different perspective. And it might not be a song that you would write today. So, you know, just curious of your thoughts on that idea of kind of where the meaning of a song lies.
Well, I can cheat and say, you know, it's both. You know, it means something to me now, and it meant something to me then. And then it's actually three things. And then the third thing is it becomes public property. Huh. There comes a point where I couldn't go back and say, I'd love to change the second verse. I think I will. You know, it's kind of naive and immature. And what was I thinking at the time? Because it's already out there, it's gone, and people, you know, sing it en masse at the Fairport Festival every year. I mean, 20,000 people sing this song. So it's not mine anymore in that sense. You know, I've got my own thoughts about it, my own version of it, and my own sense of what it means, and also my own sense of kind of wonder at what's still veiled from me about the song. It's kind of a strange song, but because it is open to a lot of interpretation, and I suppose when I was writing it, I was thinking that would be a good thing, and it seems to have turned out to be a good thing because people put their own version of it. People sing it at funerals. I had to sing it at my mother's funeral. That was the toughest gig ever. That was so hard to do that. You know, it meant something to me as a writer when I was 18 years old. I can't quite remember exactly what was going through my head. I think just some kind of semi-conscious thing was going through my head. I was, you know, enjoying the sounds of the words and the general feel of the song.
Right.
But I think at the time I didn't really understand the meaning of it, and I still don't understand the meaning of it.
Huh.
Now that can be a very bad thing in a song, or a good thing, you know. And I'll choose the idea that it's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, the third Fairport album, Unhalf Bricking, was recorded but not yet released when you survived a terrible van accident with the band that claimed the lives of your then girlfriend, as well as the Fairport drummer Martin Lamble. And you write about that so insightfully in the book. You write about that horrific event. And the song Genesis Hall on Unhalf Bricking was, as you also write in the book, you say it was, quote, about current events, countercultural events, but expressed in the language of something more ancient. And after that accident, you guys effectively just cleared the slate and really threw yourselves into becoming a new kind of band, with fiddler Dave Swarbrick joining and really pursuing that idea of what you had described about Genesis Hall, but really marrying that kind of ancient British folk tradition with rock music. And going forward, that's what you guys really did. But in addition to digging up some of these, you know, ancient songs, you and Dave took up the challenge of writing ancient sounding music, such as Crazy Man Michael.
Your future you often have asked me. Your true love will die by your own right hand. And Crazy Man
you write a lot in the book about how, you know, most British groups were so steeped in the blues and American rock and roll, but you almost had this burning mission to set that aside and embrace these specifically British roots. And as a creator, mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that that drive in some ways kind of came out of that accident, that just refocusing and wanting to sort of have a new mission and do something new? Or is that something that had really been percolating? Because it strikes me as somewhat unusual to have such a clear mission statement as a writer mm-hmm. at such a young age.
I think the accident really focused us into thinking, okay, well, we're going to do this full time. We're not going to even dip our toe into American musical styles. We're going to go 100% into a style of music that will be based on traditional British roots. So we were working on that idea, but before the accident. So you know, Sandy and I and Ashley would kind of talk about the kind of songs we wanted to write, and we were already thinking, well, we should be writing songs that really reflect much more our own culture, our own background. Hmm. So you know, you hear in some of Sandy's songs on Half Bricking or the album before even, there's a song like Fotheringay that Sandy wrote. It's very traditional based. You know, melodically, lyrically. I mean, it doesn't necessarily sound like a contemporary song. And a song like Genesis Hall, you know, melodically again and lyrically, you know, the ideas are coming much more from what we knew of English, Irish, Scottish traditional music. So we were doing that already. We were kind of trying to move our writing to this more British style. But then when the accident happened, we said, well, you know, this is a big watershed for us. Let's just go for it. Let's make an album as a statement.
Yeah.
We'll do this album called Legion Leaf. We'll do it as a project, and it will be traditional music amplified and played in a contemporary style. And it will be our own songs that are based on the tradition, that will be contemporary songs, but that they might sound like they belong as the end point of that tradition. So that was really what was going through our minds at that time.
You know, in your description of that era, you mentioned, you said, we weren't recycling recognizable American styles. If audiences there were going to like us, they'd have to take a step in our direction. And that really strikes me because, you know, there are so many stories of bands that kind of operate with this sort of breathless need for approval, and and sometimes an American audience would really loom large in that concept as something you really wanted to pursue. And for you to say, hey, if they're going to like us, we need them to take a step in our direction. I mean, that's a pretty strong level of confidence. I would imagine that also sort of is beneficial to the purity of the creative process. Was everyone in your team kind of on board with that concept of like, hey, we're going to let America come to us? Or were there any sort of like, you know, manager types who were like, yeah, but why don't you try to write something for the American kids? Or was that something that was easy for you to maintain?
Well, you know, fortunately, or some would say unfortunately, we didn't have people like that around us. Our producer, Joe Boyd, was really right behind what we were doing and thought it was a great idea. And didn't really, you know, shove us in any sense towards musical compromise. And we were very idealistic as a band. I mean, we really wanted to be different, and we really wanted to stand out and have our own voice. And this seemed to us, you know, the way to be different, to achieve that difference. I think we were all on board, and we were prepared to be unpopular. You know, just as if you're a painter or something, and you know, if you're Picasso and you start, you know, painting things somewhat angular, you know, and strange, you're not courting popularity. Yeah, you're being daring, and maybe the audience will pick up on it. maybe they pick up on it 10 years later or 20 years later. But you kind of have to do what you have to do. And for us, music was always about trying to be original and about trying to be valid, I suppose, and expressing our own culture more strongly.
Well, you continued that ethic, you know, with the fifth Fairport album, Full House, you know, with more songs that you wrote with Dave, who we mentioned before in the last question, yeah. including the classic Sloth. But after that record, you stepped away from the band. And about that period, you write, I was writing songs on my own and they were weird. Perhaps now is the time to stop thinking of writing in a band context and start expressing all that was coming out. And elsewhere, you call them the strange, surreal songs I was collecting in my notebooks. It almost seems like even the next step into, hey, I don't care if these are popular, but just, you know, writing songs that felt like maybe they had to be written. Did the songs seem weird, strange, or puzzling to you at the time? Or is that just sort of the way that you sensed that others were perceiving them?
No, to me, they seemed weird. They seemed... eccentric. I think I used that word in the book actually. I was taking like slices of what I knew of the British tradition, but not the whole thing. I was just taking it that these little slices and writing these songs the kind of fit but didn't fit. They were a curious contemporary extension of the tradition, maybe, and it didn't really understand the songs, but they seemed to want to exist, and I was happy to help them have a life, if you like, and I felt that, you know, that record, the Henry the Human Fly record, it kind of it's of a piece, you know, the songs were written in a certain time frame, and they seem to belong to each other in that sense, you know, it's a strange record. So some people still say it's the best record I ever did, and you know, that's very disheartening. I've been wasting my time for the last 50 years, but thank you anyway.
Right. You write in the book that Henry the Human Fly was, quote, released to universal indifference, which was funny. But you talk about the opening track, Roll Over Vaughn Williams, which you kind of described as an encapsulation of the statement of the whole album.
If you listen, if you should, we won't be misunderstood. But don't expect the words to ring too sweetly on me.
You know, it's an album that, as you wrote in retrospect about those songs, you said, you know, that recording them, you know, and putting them down into a tangible form, putting them onto an LP would perhaps help you gain some perspective about, you know, their meaning or you know, what what exactly these new and strange songs that we're coming to were all about. Once that record, you know, was recorded and released, yeah. I mean, did kind of hearing them back as one piece of work, did that help you gain some kind of perspective on your own process?
I suppose it did, yes. But I felt that I wanted to move on as well. I didn't want to dwell on that record at the time. I got very little positive feedback about it. And so I thought, well, you know, as one does in music, you know, you do a show and it's not a very good show. You think, well, you know, tomorrow is another gig. And I thought, well, you know, next 6 months is another record. I kind of forgot about it almost, and I started writing songs for the next record, which to me was more interesting because I was now working with Linda, so there's another voice coming into the format, and it was a whole different world of inspiration for me.
Yeah, you mentioned your then wife, Linda, and in 1974, the two of you released I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight, which was your first album as a duo, and that includes classic songs like The End of the Rainbow, The Calvary Cross, and the title track. Talking about sort of collecting these ideas in the final stages of the previous album, and I understand that those came from a couple pages worth of title ideas that you had written down during that process and working from titles. Is that kind of a usual part of your process to start with a title and work that way? Was that something that was specific to that one record?
I think it was predominant on that one record. I think I've been reading Woody Guthrie's Bound for Glory. And he says, "Oh, ideas for songs are easy." He says, "Yeah, here's a few titles for songs." And he writes writes a page of titles, the Boxcar Blues, or the Brakeman's Blues, and some are really funny, But I thought that's great. He's just gone boom, 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 and you can almost take all of those titles and turn those into songs and turn that into a great album. So I thought, well, I'll just jot some titles down. And while we were mixing Henry the Human Fly, I thought I'll just jot down some titles. And I wrote down 20 or 30 titles. And bizarrely, or not so bizarrely, all of those ended up as songs on the next album.
Wow. Hmm. Do you find yourself gravitating to titles when you see another artist's work, and you go, "Oh, I got to check out what that song's about. That title is really compelling."
Yeah, I like titles. I really do. Charles Dickens, was a big fan of titles and names. Mm. Like he had to get people's names right, and he agonized over the names. And once he had the name, he had the whole thing. He could write it really, really quickly.
Yeah.
But just getting that was Dickens' starting point. Was to just to get the names of things right. Famously, Charles Dickens, when he moved to his new house. In Gad's Hill, he had a false bookcase made, which had a sort of hidden door behind it, and he had the builder but put false book titles on the false books, and he told the builder exactly what the titles were, and they're hilarious, they're so funny. So if you stumble into Dickens' house. And you came across this particular bookshelf, you just fall over laughing. I mean, it's hilarious. So he loved titles, and I'm a bit that way myself as well.
I would call that disposable income.
You could say that, yeah, absolutely.
Well, of the process of writing that I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight record, you reflected in the book, you said, "Parents, partners, and friends rarely understand that staring blankly out the window is as an important part of the creative process and only occasionally an excuse for doing nothing." In other words, the work of songwriting doesn't always look like work to a casual observer. And, we're always fascinated with what that looks like for different people when we have these conversations. Sometimes people write in sort of bursts where they're writing nonstop for a while, and then they might not write for a good bit of time. You have kind of the Nashville style, which you alluded to, which was writing by appointment in a way. And I'm curious, are you someone who puts in that work in a disciplined way, where you say, "Okay, I'm going to wake up and write this many hours each day," or are you more the type of person who just kind of waits for inspiration to strike? How does it look for you?
I think I do both. I like the disciplined approach, and left to my own devices and left with a bit of free time. If I've got a couple of weeks where I'm not doing anything, I'll say, "Okay, I'm going to write every day. I'm going to start at 7 a.m. Early starting is very, very good for me. So I'll start at 7, I'll write till lunchtime, and then I'll knock off, or if it's going really well, I'll keep going. And then if it's going really well, I'll keep going into the night. And then if it's going really well, I'll dream about it. And then I'll wake up the next day with a whole bunch of new ideas. but with that approach, I find that there's a kind of a burnout point. I can do that for, you know, so many days. And then I get kind of exhausted. And my brain won't stop. And I have to do things to stop myself going crazy, with you know, my head exploding. So, you know, I have to watch movies or something. That some visual distraction is very good to get me out of it again. Because I think if I was in it all the time, I'd probably, you know, I'd die. I'd just die from exhaustion. So, you know, there are kind of limits. So I love the disciplined approach. I also, you know, I love the idea that you find things all the time. This is expression of keeping the shop open. You know, day or night, you're always alert to the idea that there are songs out there.
Yeah.
And I'm always getting told off for in the middle of a conversation, like kind of drifting away when someone's talking to me. And I'm not being rude. I'm just there's this idea. I just like got some idea, and I had to go and write it down. It seems very rude, but it has to be done, as we know. And if you don't grab the ideas, they don't come back. So you have to be alert to that.
Yeah,
you just say, I'm not being rude. It's just what you're saying is not as compelling as my own thoughts. So,
yeah, you're actually a very boring person. So that's what I'm going to think of something else. Yeah.
You know, in terms of what goes on in your heart and mind, and even how your disposition plays into the things that you write, on an album like I Want to See the Bright Lights, there are some fairly bleak lyrical themes. I mean, you look at The End of the Rainbow, and it says, your mother works so hard to make you happy, but take a look outside the nursery door. There's nothing at the end of the rainbow. There's nothing to grow up for anymore. And those, you know, those could be the type of lyrics that come from a dark, brooding spirit, or they could be the kind of things that sort of exercise those demons and allow you to live a carefree and happier life because you got that thought out of your brain. How does it work for you?
Well, I'd like to think the latter was true, and that I am a fairly, you know, happy, well-adjusted person, and I do get the demons out, I think, a lot in the songwriting. Yeah, it's not a very happy song, is it? Now I think about it. I think of a song like that, it's a state and not a station. You know, a state is something that you pass through, and a station is something that's fixed. That's where the parts of you that are kind of fixed are the station. And I think as you pass through states, you can pass through states that really are quite dark, but you don't live there. You visit them, and you have to visit them. It's a passing thing, and you're glad you went there, but you're glad you don't live there all the time. Mm-hmm. And the song is a kind of a reminder. Like when you sing the song, you think, okay, there's that dark place, and I could go there, and I could wallow in it, but I don't want to. I'll look at it. I'll hold it up to the audience as well, and I'll say, look at this. Isn't this dark? And the audience goes, oh shit, it is dark. And right. But then at the end of the song, you kind of put it back in your pocket, you know, and the audience can kind of breathe a sigh of relief. But they've lived with you through that song. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's cathartic for them. Maybe it's cathartic for you. It could be. In a sense, that's not the point of the song, but it is something that might be a byproduct of the song.
I feel for you. Horror, safe at your mother's breast. No lucky break for you around the corner. As your father is a bully, and he thinks that you're a pest. And your sister, she's no better than. Life seems so rosy in the gray.
write in your book about how you were drawn to the Muslim faith and embraced Sufism in the mid-70s, and your third album with Linda, Pour Down Like Silver, was the first record entirely written after your spiritual awakening, and there are songs on the album like Beat the Retreat, Night Comes In, and the oft-covered Dimming of the Day that you have described as songs of yearning, which I think is an interesting description. And I'm curious, was there a sense on, you know, on your part at the time that your spirituality was transforming the way that you approached the art and craft of writing songs?
Yes, I think at the time, absolutely. I think I was always that person. I was always spiritually looking for something, and trying to connect to the universe, you know, trying to connect to the big picture, and trying to understand what life is all about, as we all do. And so I was aware at the time, and I suppose I wrote songs almost with the awareness that I was learning more about the universe, about spirituality. Again, I mean, I didn't necessarily know where I was going with it, but I wrote the songs and they satisfied me at the time, and some of them have had, as you say, I've had some mileage. Song like Dimming of the Day, I think touches a place for a lot of people. And again, that's one of your jobs as a songwriter is to touch people, is to emotionally engage people and emotionally affect people. I'm glad I'm able to do that from time to time. I think the Dimming of the Day does do that thing. It is a song of yearning.
This old house is falling down around my ears. I'm drowning.
It's nice to feel that you know when someone else sings your song, that's a wonderful feeling. That they would care enough about that song to want to sing it themselves, and invest it with their own emotion and their own feelings about it. In some cases, to not necessarily understand what you were thinking about the song, but you know, to give it their own perspective and to run with it in a whole different way sometimes. So that's a good feeling as a writer.
The last Richard and Linda Thompson album, Shoot Out the Lights, released in 1982, is considered a classic and includes classic songs such as Walking on a Wire, Wall of Death, and the title track. But between the time the album was recorded and when you went on tour to support it, your marriage famously fell apart. And even though the songs were written before you guys split up, the songs on the album kind of effectively foretold, you know, the ending of the relationship. And, you know, we've talked a lot about sort of the nature of how songs originate. Are they created or are they given? Are they found or downloaded? Do you feel that in a sense, sort of your songwriting muse kind of knew what was going on before you even consciously were aware of it, in a way that you were writing about your own life before you knew it was your own life?
I think so. I think subconsciously, I must have been picking up on, the problems that we had with our marriage. We got married young. in some ways we were very compatible. In some ways, where we probably weren't. We probably had different ideas of where the marriage should go, and I was probably, you know, picking up on all that stuff, you know, semi-consciously, subconsciously, you know, as songwriters do, you know, the irony of singing these songs, you know, as the marriage crumbles, it's quite strange, really. And also, you know, sometimes we would swap lead vocals. Mm. So people say, oh, that's Linda expressing this and this and this. But originally, like, it might have been me singing it. And we just decided that the key was wrong or something. So it's not quite that simple. I wasn't putting words in Linda's mouth necessarily. Mm. Or in my own mouth. So, you know, I wrote the songs. The songs are kind of there.
Yeah.
We interpreted them, and you know, the album came out, and then people thought, "Oh, it's a breakup album." In a sense, it is, but in a sense, it wasn't intended to be.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I was a kid, my dad had a cassette tape in his car that was. It was comprised of songs that made him feel fantastic. Like, this was his cassette tape that he pulled out, you know, on a sunny day when the windows were down, and he just wanted to feel good. And he was very particular about what songs made it onto the cassette. It was like an evolving play. It was like before there was such a thing as a playlist. My dad was curating his own very short, you know, happy day cassette thing. But the first song on that cassette was Joel Sanier's cover of your song Tear Stained Letter, which was the opening track on your 1983 solo album Hand of Kindness. And, you know, Joel Sanier's version, unsurprisingly, you know, really grasped onto the Zydeco flavored elements that, you know, were there in your version, but you also had prominent horns in your version. When I look at your, you know, catalog as a whole, you have made records that range from super stripped down and acoustic to edgy to, you know, kind of country flavored guitar gymnastics. I mean, there is a lot for people to find in your music. It's not like, oh, here's another Richard Thompson album. We know exactly what that's going to sound like. You know, there's a lot of influences and a lot of ground that you explore, which makes me curious, you know, as a songwriter, when you're writing songs, and they're first, you know, kind of coming to you and you're shaping them, are you kind of hearing, you know, production in your head as you write, or hearing how the sonics of this song might be delivered? Or is everything just kind of a blank slate of lyric and melody for you, and then these things start to kind of take shape in the studio?
Mm-hmm. I think it varies. I think some things, you have no idea how they're going to turn out on a record. And often I think those are the songs that are just, it's just you and a guitar, that they end up pretty much acoustic, with maybe a little sweetening here and there. And other things, I think you really hear the whole thing. You know, yeah, you might be playing, I mean, I usually work from an acoustic guitar anyway, but in the acoustic guitar, you hear things, you know, you hear the drums, you hear the arrangement, and so you have a fairly clear direction. So when you get to the studio, you can pretty much direct it and tell the musicians what you'd like to hear. And there's always surprises. I mean, there's always things that people play differently that take it somewhere slightly other. But with a song like that was pretty much, a song like Tear Stained Letter, that was pretty much as intended, you know, from the very beginning, you know, as I was working on it. And, you know, some songs start from thinking, I need an up-tempo song for my live show. You know, that's a kind of a valid starting point. And a song like that doesn't have to be too serious lyrically. It can be kind of light and funny, if you like. But often, you know, the things start there. Or you say, you know, I need immediate medium tempo song. I need a song in 3/4. These are all places which can be jumping off points for the songwriter. So however you get there, it doesn't really matter. But it's you know, sometimes just being a musician that plays live can direct the kind of songs that you write.
Hmm. You know, in songs like Tear-Stained Letter or a song like Twist the Knife Again from 1985's Across a Crowded Room album, I actually hear a little bit of kind of punk energy in those. A lot of observers noted a shift, though, with the Daring Adventures album in 1986, which was your first to be recorded entirely in the U.S. after you had permanently moved to California. There was not only the sonics, but there was kind of a perceived emphasis on more character-driven material, songs like Valerie and Al Boley's In Heaven. Do you feel like a change of environment had an impact on your writing approach? I mean, particularly coming to America, which was an influence that you had resisted earlier in your career.
Yeah. I don't think it affected the writing. I think it did strongly affect the recording process. I get feedback from people saying, we don't like the sound of those Mitchell Froom produced records. It sounds too commercial almost. And perhaps they're right. I mean, I don't know. I felt slightly like a fish out of water when I started recording in America. It was a lot of fun. I mean, I loved working with Mitchell. I mean, he had just great ideas. But I felt almost as if, you know, the rhythm section was leading me rather than me directing the rhythm section, for instance. Because how do you, you know, you've got Jim Keltner there, you've got Jerry Sheff, you know, these amazing players. And I probably felt a little intimidated to be telling them what to do. And I'm not sure that what I would have told them would have worked anyway. It was a lot of fun. But would I do that again? I probably wouldn't in many ways. I mean, I'm happy to record in America, but I now have a band where we've been together long enough that they kind of know what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
That they have the chops and the styles to interpret my songs more closely, perhaps. Yeah. I would say that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the 1990s, you had a series of successful releases on Capitol Records, particularly the Rumor and Psy album, which was nominated for a Grammy. And that album yielded great songs like I Misunderstood and I Feel So Good, which was the single off that album. But the song that I think has really become the biggest classic is 1952 Vincent Black Lightning.
Oh, says Red Molly to James, that's a fine motorbike. A girl could feel special on any such like. Says James to Red Molly, my hat's off to you. It's a Vincent Black Lightning 1952. And I've seen you at the corners and cafes, it seems. Red hair and black leather, my favorite color scheme. And he pulled her on behind and down to Box Hill they did ride.
If you're American, writing songs is easier. I wouldn't say easy, but easier, because there's more romance and there's more resonance in the names of places and objects. You mention a Cadillac or a Buick or something, that already has a kind of a romance to it, a resonance to it, because it's been in so many songs, and it's you know, it's kind of built into the landscape. And town names in America, you know, Memphis, you know, New Orleans, you know, you've written half a song there just by mentioning those names. Yeah. In Britain, it's much harder. And I think I was searching for, you know, an object around which you could build a song. And when I was a kid, you know, the Vincent was the motorcycle. That was the really expensive one, the really fast one, the really sexy looking one. You know, the Black Shadow, the Black Lightning. They just look so amazing. Hmm. And one of my neighbor's dads had a Vincent. You know, so that always stayed in my mind. You know, that would be a great thing to write a song about. Yeah. And really, you know, the drama is just built around the motorcycle. That's the whole thing. So the characters are just characters that move in and out of the frame of reference of the bike. And people seem to like it. I mean, you know, the other thing is you never know if a song's going to be popular, if people are going to get it. That seems to be a song that people understand and do get they do get the emotion of the song. And thanks to Del McCoury, who did a bluegrass version of it and changed a couple of names here and there, which right. helps. You know, it was like a bluegrass hit, which is, you know, bizarre in one sense, but gratifying in another sense.
You know, I'm always interested when we talk with songwriters about, you know, not only their own songs, but what songs by, you know, other artists particularly impress them, or things that they look at and they go, wow, I wish I'd written that or whatever. And you did a tour and a album, a live album that accompanied it, called 1000 Years of Popular Music. And it was, it was exactly what it sounds like. You really had dug out some very ancient songs, but you went from, you know, ancient times all the way up to the present day. And one of the covers on that record was Oops, I Did It Again, the Britney Spears song. And I think, you know, at first people would go, wait, what the heck? That doesn't seem, I mean, that was a pretty new song at the time. It reminds me of when I was in my 20s. I remember I was having a conversation with a musician who I respected as being a far greater musician than I. And in my insecurity, I kind of made a crack about, you know, Shania Twain. And he said something about, yeah, well, you try to write a song that's as catchy as Shania Twain's hits. You know, it might sound simple, but you know, it's not for the faint of heart. Kind of put me in my place a little bit, because I was being snobbish. You know, I was dismissing her music because I guess the way it was packaged or whatever. And so having kind of identifying with that idea of being willing to look past the packaging of something or the marketing of something and say, hey, when you strip this back, what's there? You know, what is the song at the root of, you know, of the record or however it's produced or marketed. But I'm really curious, even with all that said, it still seems, a bit incongruous to think of Richard Thompson standing on stage singing, Oops, I Did It Again. What is it in particular about that song that draws you to it?
You know, it was recommended to me, but by a friend who said, you know, you're doing this show, 1000 Years of Popular Music. You should really do this Britney Spears song. And I was slightly incredulous. And he said, no, listen to the song, And he was right. You know, it's a good song. It has good bones as a song. It's got a good melody, and it's got good lyrics. And if you take it away from the bombast of Britney's version, it reveals itself. And I think the version that we did was a fitting tribute to, you know, a well-constructed piece of popular music.
But to lose all my senses, it's just so typically me. Ooh, baby, oops, I did it again. I play with your heart, got lost in the game. Ooh, baby, oops, you think I'm in love, that I sent from above.
curious to hear one of your songs produced that way.
All right, go the other way.
to see.
Me too. I guess I'll be laughing all the way to the bank. Thank you.
Well, you know, in that early 2000s period, kind of ironically, after years of releasing albums for major labels, you end up becoming an indie artist and finding wider audiences and more success than you ever had before. Oftentimes, with conversations that we have, we would attribute that kind of success to the fact that an artist is now unencumbered from the desires of some cigar-chomping record exec suit, but you never seemed like you were particularly burdened by that type of thing anyway. And all you did was just keep writing songs that really resonated. You know, there are dozens of examples, but one song that seemed to particularly connect is Dad's Gonna Kill Me.
Out in the desert, there's a soldier lying dead. Vultures pecking the eyes out of his head. Another day that could have been me there instead. Nobody loves me here. Nobody loves me here. Dad's gonna kill me. Dad's gonna kill me. You hit the booby trap and you're in pieces. With every bullet you're risking creases.
I was reading letters and diaries from the Iraq War, and I was struck by the language and the emotions expressed as well. The troops did not want to be there. They didn't want to be doing what they were doing. But often, when you have a war like that, you almost have to indoctrinate your own army and say that these people are bad. These people are doing this. They're doing that. The whole premise of the war was very strange, and so sometimes you get a situation that, like Iraq, and you don't send the troops in. I suppose the consequence of that was the destabilization of the Middle East, because Iran and Iraq were kind of in balance, and when you upset that balance, then Iran becomes stronger, and things change. So, you know, I was interested in the language and the way that the troops felt, and I thought it was worthy of a song. So I tried to incorporate some of the slang and some of the feeling that I got from the letters and diaries of the troops. It's been a fairly popular song. I get a lot of feedback about this song, and I get feedback from the GIs who are there, who say thank you for writing the song. It says something for us. It expresses our feelings about the situation.
Wow. Yeah. Well, recent years have found you recording albums with producers who are also artists in their own right, and I think of Buddy Miller, who's one of my personal favorite artists. He was at the helm for your 2013 album, Electric. Jeff Tweedy of Wilco sat in the producer's chair for your 2015 album, Still, which included, you know, great songs such as Beatnik Walking.
Hand me down my walking shoes, Mr. Murdoch's news. I'm going thunder, rain or shine. Got a papoose on my back. We're on the right track, Jack, to leave the beatnik blues behind. Amsterdam, where good things come in threes. Soothe your troubled mind and shoot the breeze.
In what ways did those kind of collaborations draw out different parts of your artistry by having someone who is also an artist, you know, in the room, in that producer role?
I think Tweedy and Buddy both brought fairly different things to the table. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to work with other producers sometimes is because I get bored with my own ideas about how to record, and I think, well, I'll just throw myself into a whole different environment and have another set of ears. I can bounce ideas off, that they can throw suggestions at me. And it will turn out different. And in both cases, it certainly did. In the case of Jeff Tweedy, it was interesting that he was really concerned about song structure. I think more than anything else, his production was pretty much the same production that I would have done, actually. But he made really good suggestions about, well, you know, you don't need that verse there. There's too many bass drum beats there. You know, just cut some of the bass drum pattern. Really interesting suggestions, things I would never have thought of. Hmm. And with Buddy Miller, I think he just had a whole other way of hearing the sound. You know, they're like the ensemble sound of the bass and the drums, the guitars and what have you. And his focus was much more to let me get on with the songwriting. Hmm. To get a kind of a garage feel about the sound of it,
yeah.
Which I really liked as well. And it was all done in Buddy's house, which is great fun, you know, to record at his house.
You know, I'm struck in your book how you write about just that draw of British traditions, and you know, being so much shaped in your formative years as a songwriter by the passion to really find your place in that lineage. And it makes me think, if 1,000 years from now there is an artist who is going back and, you know, finding the roots that will continue on long after we're all gone, I know this is probably impossible to answer, but is there a song or a, you know, two or three songs that come to your mind that you feel particularly proud of that you have contributed to the canon, so to speak? So that if someone was, you know, as those traditions continue on and someone's looking back from the perspective of, you know, where we're living now being history, what kind of comes to your mind that you would be proud for someone to find and embrace and reinterpret for those times?
I think the songs that really count, you know, the ones that you're proud of, the ones that you say, okay, these are the good songs. They're ones that move people. As a songwriter, you want to move people. Yeah, you want people to cry, you know. Not every song, but most songs. So you know, something like "The Ghost of You Walks," I'd be very proud of. Even a song like "Dimming of the Day," I'd be proud of. But you know, that person trawling back 1,000 years is probably going to go for, you know, Pat Benatar or something. So I'm sure it won't be me.
You never know.
but you never know. There's always hope, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, the book is Bee's Wing. It's out in paperback now, and it has been a remarkable career. And the book only scratches the surface of the first part of it, and we've only scratched the surface of many things that have happened in the years since then. But we really appreciate your time, Richard, to just kind of take a brief overview of your career from the lens of songwriting. You are someone who is a master of his craft, and it is an honor to speak with you.
Well, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'd love to stay connected with you, so please take a moment to subscribe to Songcraft via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice.
If you like the show, we ask you to consider rating us and leaving us a good review. Word of mouth is important, and letting other potential listeners know what you think of the show helps us tremendously. And of course, nothing beats a personal recommendation. Perhaps take a moment right now to text or email one friend who you think would appreciate what we do, and send them a link to our show, letting them know how much you enjoy it.
As a reminder, you can sign up for our email list at songcraftshow.com and find out how to help support us at patreon.com/songcraftshow.
And you can follow us on social media by searching for Songcraft Conversations on Instagram and Songcraft Show on Facebook and Twitter.
Thanks, as always, for listening and for your support.